Hey there, sports history fan. Arnie Chapman here from the Sports History Network. Now, before you jump into this episode, I wanted to share with you an exciting giveaway we have going on with Home Field Apparel. We have a digital $50 gift card to homefieldapparel.com for one lucky fan of the Sports History Network. All you got to do is head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways to sign up. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways.
We have a great program in store for this one because our friend Tim Brown drops by the Pigpen to get us ready to watch some CFL football that's hopefully starting soon, and also shares the rebranding of his website into footballarchaeology.com with all the things that us lovers of football history like. Tim's up to talk about this and more coming up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. Welcome once again to the Pigpen, your portal to positive football history. And as every day, we like to dive back into some good football history. And what a better way to do it than to do it with friends. And we have a guest that we've had on before. Author Tim Brown is with us. It's not the legendary Hall of Fame football player Tim Brown. It is the legendary author and historian, archaeologist Tim Brown, who is a wealth of knowledge, and we're always excited to have him. Tim Brown, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Hey, Darren, thank you. At least I have more money than the other Tim Brown, so yeah. I'm good. I'm good at that.
Yeah, that was good. That's great if you got more money than him. I sure don't, that's for sure. So Tim, you have really got some exciting things going on. You've had some changes to your branding since the last time we talked to you. Maybe you'd like to share some of that, what you have going on.
Yeah, sure. So, anybody who follows my stuff would probably know this already, but I have been, I wrote a book now 5-6 years ago called Fields of Friendly Strife. And so I created website to kind of promote that, and then to do some additional writing, cover things that I hadn't quite, there's things you have to cut out of a book. And so, things you can spin additional yarns on. But over time I was writing less and less about that topic, and more in line with the book, which was how football became football. So, all kinds of nice about how football evolved and the story that went along with that. So, what I ended up doing was I also wanted to get off. I was on a WordPress platform, which provides a lot of flexibility, but it was great when I started because I didn't know where I was going to go with things. But it turned out most of them I'm writing and I'm, inserting pictures and things like that. So I didn't need a lot of flexibility, didn't need a lot of functions that I was basically paying for and having the technical pain that goes along with that. So I've switched everything over to a platform called Substack. That's really a newsletter or platform, but all stores everything. So you can go on anytime and look at the archives of what's been written. And it makes it very easy. It's much cleaner. And one of the things that's allowed me to do was everything that I wrote in the past was what I'd call long form. It's kind of an essay on the history of some particular topic. 5-10 minute read, that kind of thing. But Substack is so easy to work with that, I've now started these daily little modules, kind of bite-sized chunks. And I call them today's tidbit. And it's just, sometimes it's little portions of things that I've written about before, but other times there's all kinds of little things you find that don't warrant a whole article, but they're just kind of interesting tidbits. And so, each day, 7 o'clock Eastern, I post one of those out, and then I put it on Twitter as well, and that's good. And so depending on how you digest information, you can find me on those three places.
Yeah, they're extremely interesting. I've subscribed to it, and it's great to get that little bit of, you know, like you said, it's little jolts of football information. You know, the one you had most recently, the night we were recording this, is on, you know, football cleats and sort of their history and how you know, football players back in yesteryear started wearing cleats and changing their cleats and going to the cobbler. It was fascinating. It was like a 20, 30 second read with a beautiful picture too. So really set the point across. So very well done on the tidbits.
Yeah. Thank you. They're fun. You know, I'm doing research on one thing or another and I cross a little thing. It's like, oh, that could make a 10. And so I just make a note of it. And, you know, 2 days later, I just put it in the queue.
Yeah. It's a very fascinating. It's great, great feed. Maybe you could share with our listeners if they want to subscribe to get the tidbits each day in their email or follow you on social media so they get the tidbits. If you want to share your information right now, we can share it again at the end as well.
Sure. So my site is, it's a Substack site, but it's called, so it's www.footballarchaeology.com. And so the, you know, just one string of characters, and you just have to make sure that you spell archaeology correctly, which is archaeology. And then, you know, if you can find me on Twitter the same way. There's actually another football archaeology that's in the UK, but I'm the one where the two words are pushed together. And I think you can find me on Facebook searching football archaeology too. So, you know, any one of those three is a way to get there. But if you want to make, you know, if you like it and you want to make sure you don't miss an episode, just subscribe to Football Archaeology. You can do either a free subscription or paid. And then it'll show up and you'll get an email every day with that information. So, you know, read it at your leisure or just come and visit the site whenever it makes sense for you.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, that's great, great information. I highly suggest that to the listeners because it's a great bit of get your football brain filled with some more information to look at the history and preserve the history of football, which is what we do and what we enjoy. But I, you know, I think it's a really interesting name that you chose to rebrand from the, you know, the Fields of Friendly Strife to Football Archaeology, because that's really, in essence, that paints a great picture, really what you do. You know, starting with your book, you know, how football became football and, you know, what you've been doing lately on you know, the Fields of Friendly Strife and now Football Archaeology site, because you really dive into it with some great investigation and pick up those little, I guess, nuances of the game and how they came about, which is really fascinating how some of these things, you know, have evolved. And that's one particular thing that I really enjoy about the site.
Yeah, I just thought, you know, I just have always enjoyed kind of how systems develop. And so, you know, it's very easy to go through, you know, just look at the game today and just say, well, it's always been like this. Well, you know, it hasn't. There's been lots and lots of changes. And there's kind of a neat, you know, there's a neat concept. I won't get into it too far here, but in evolution, you know, in the biological sense of evolution, there's an idea that, you know, species can only evolve so far at one time, right? And, you know, human systems like football, it's the same way. There's things that, you know, like when they first started, well, when they legalized forward pass in 1906, people didn't know what to make of this thing. You know, they basically passed it forward just kind of like they passed, you know, what we call handoff or a toss, they called it a pass at the time, you know, the backwards pass. They pretty much did the same thing, two-handed pushes and things like that. They couldn't conceive, or most of them couldn't conceive of what we now think is, you know, downfield overhand spiral passes. You know, just they didn't know how to do, you know, they couldn't even imagine that.
So it was more of like the, what we would call today, like a shovel pass when it throw forward.
Yeah. That kind of thing. And, you know, I mean, there's, you know, I've got some stuff coming up. One of the blog articles that I'm writing right now is, you know, football and night, or the forward pass in 1906. And so I've got some plays, you know, that people drew up and published in newspapers. And some of them were just, you know, it was like a sweep, you know, student body right kind of thing. And whoever had the ball would, if he was about to be tackled, he just kind of push it couple yards in front of one of his blockers, you know, for them. So that's how they were conceiving of the forward. It was like a forward lateral, not a forward pass. They didn't have the word lateral yet, but, you know, that's the, you know, so right. I mean, there's just things like that.
Well, you know, from my officiating days, I had when I was a rookie official and I was first getting on a crew, we had an old veteran referee on there. And anytime you said the word lateral, he would flip out. He goes, "There's no such thing as a lateral. Lateral is exactly sideways. That's the definition of lateral. It's either forward or backwards pass." You know, I never call it a lateral. So every time I hear lateral, I still cringe because he frightened the bejeebies out of me, if you know what I mean. But
yeah. Well, the lateral, the Yaleys were the ones called it a lateral. So blame them.
Right. Yeah. Well, I guess we better address the elephant room, or maybe more appropriately, the tiger in the room. As the listeners can't see this, but you know, Tim and I are via Zoom call and we can see each other. And Tim came on, he's got showed me a bottle of beer from Canada, and he's got a Hamilton Tiger Cats sweatshirt on. And I think we might be having a theme here of what Tim's came on to talk about tonight. So Tim, I'm going to let you lead the way here, and something that's very timely and appropriate for this time of year.
Yeah. So first I have to put in a plug for Le Fin du Monde, the beer that I'm drinking. Some people like the Canadian maple syrup. I prefer their other liquid. So if Unibrew Brewery wants to, you know, shoot me some money, you know, I'll take it.
Yeah. You'll take the liquid payment, right?
Yeah. So, So the day that you release this, if all goes to plan, which is on Friday, the Canadian football preseason will start. And so, you know, I guess I'm here to talk a little bit about Canadian football. And I, you know, I'm not a huge, you know, it's not like I know Canadian football inside or out. And you know? I have researched it more from a historical standpoint. But I've been to, you know, half a dozen games over the years. I subscribe to TSN so that I can watch Canadian football as soon as it comes on, and, you know, in late May, early June, and I watch games through the season. And so, you know, it's great football. It's fun, interesting game. It's just it's football. It's just, you know, some differences in the rules, right? And so, you know, I've written, I think, four different articles now about Canadian football, mostly from an American perspective, right? What's different about the Canadian rules versus American? How did they evolve differently? You know, why don't they? And basically, it's kind of some of it's a theme of why do they mess with our great game, right? Why do those silly Canadians do this silly thing and have a wider field and only three downs? And so some of my writing is to try to explain, well, why did it evolve that way in Canada versus our great game, right? And at least half the time, the Americans are to blame. You know, we're the ones who changed things. It wasn't the Canadians.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You know, that's comes up all the time. I have people coming on and like, you know, why, you know, just like you said, why do the Canadians take a good game and just, you know, morph it into this? You know, it's only part of the game. And but I'm not going to steal any of the thunder. This is a great topic to talk about. So I'll let you continue.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, there's at its core, they're the same game, right? There's a reason why. Canadian football is dominated by American quarterbacks. There's a reason why they're fighting right now in their contracts about how many Americans they can have play on the field, you know, be on the field at any given time. And so the, you know, coaches, players transfer very readily between the two games because they're so similar. And yet there are some differences. And, you know, I think there's a few differences, and I think Canadian game is a lot better than the American games, both for safety reasons and otherwise. So, you know, I guess that one of the biggest things that, you know, I think most of your audience probably is an American audience. One of the biggest things people need to understand about Canadian football is that, you know, I mean, they both started from rugby, American football and Canadian rugby. I think Americans have a general sense of how their game evolved. But the Canadian game stayed much truer to rugby for a lot longer. It remained pretty much of a rugby game. They adopted some portions of American football, pre-1903, but a lot of it was rugby-like. They did adopt the scrimmage, fairly early on. So, the game paused and they had a snap. But just like American football, initially we snapped with the foot, not with the hands. The center or the snapper back, they called it at the time, rolled the ball under his foot back to the quarterback, and then he had to toss it to somebody else and advance the ball, much like a rugby scrum. So, they kept doing that until 1921. We stopped doing that in like 1892. They started off with different size field and things like that. But then they got to a point where there was kind of a pressure to try to adopt some of the American game. And then there were others who were like, no, we don't want any of that, both because it's more dangerous and because it's American. They wanted to keep a Canadian game. So, but there was a guy named Burnside. And so they adopted the Burnside rules in 1903, which pretty much brought a lot of, brought a lot of American football elements into Canadian rugby. And, but then they pretty much dropped that after a couple of years. So there were parts of American football that stayed, parts of, and then other parts they returned to the Canadian rugby game.
Now, don't a lot of people up in Canada equate Burnside to almost like the Canadian Walter Camp? Don't they? Isn't that, I've heard that mentioned quite a few times.
Yeah, I think he was critical in the development of the game, and yet they also tossed out his rule, a lot of his rules. So, it's kind of a half and half.
Yeah, that's true. The other thing I always found kind of interesting is because some of Walter Camp's ideas, he gets sometimes, I love, big fan of Walter Camp and everything he did, but some of the things he did, I've had readings where I've seen where some of his, he borrowed some ideas from McGill University when they came down and played Harvard in, was that 1874? And I don't think he watched the game, but, I'm sure it by osmosis it got down to Yale. And so some of those ideas with the downs and some of that actually came from Canada. And sometimes we get more credit than we deserve for with Walter Camp of changing rugby into football, but a lot of it was Canadian first.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that the Canadians influenced Camp from a downs perspective that early on. I mean, for sure the McGill University Harvard game was really the reason why we opted for rugby. It was a chain of events, but that's what drove Americans to rugby rather than soccer, because they were basically playing soccer up until then. And the, Princeton Rutgers game that everybody talks about, that was a soccer match, round ball, kicking the ball, that kind of thing. It wasn't quite soccer, but it was just much closer to soccer than what, most people would like to admit. One of the places where, Camp went up, there were a lot of changes made between 1905 and 1906. And during the season of 1905, Camp went up to Hamilton to watch a Hamilton Tigers game. They weren't, the Cats kind of merged with them later on, but, and it was from, they had adopted, the Canadians adopted, 3 downs for 10 yards, whereas American football was playing 3 downs for 5 yards at the time. And he liked that idea, tried to bring it down, and, basically the, he couldn't get it through the committee. But then they did change it. Ultimately, they changed it in 1912. They adapted 3 yards for 3 downs for 10 yards in 1906. And then in 1912, they switched it to 4 downs for 10 yards. So, that's just an example of Burnside rules. The Canadians adopted what we were doing at the time, And then we're the ones that changed it to four downs, right? So they stuck with our rule and we changed it. So the difference is, if you don't like the difference, it's because the Americans changed it.
And that was basically an effort to, you know, they're still trying to clean up the roughness of the game. You know, we know the big change happened in 1906, but it took some years to evolve away from that just brutal running game, which you eloquently quite well say in your book, How Football Became Football. So,
yeah, I think it was one of those things where, you know, the Canadians went to the Canadians recognized that three downs for 10 yards would force, I mean, they had a wider field too, but that would force a more open game. You know, you couldn't just pound the ball up the gut and expect to get you know, 10 yards and three downs. So that made a lot of sense. But then the Americans, you know, with few exceptions, basically once they switched to three downs, 10 yards, they just kept pounding up the gut, you know, and they weren't really making, you know, the game was still, you know, some of the terrible things were disposed of, but so that's when they went to four downs. You know, and again, they couldn't figure out how to do the forward pass effectively, those kinds of things. So, you know, it took a while for those changes and the openness to really open up.
Okay. Very interesting. So the Canadians just kept that down. That's one of the big differences, I guess, between a CFL game and an NFL game, just those three downs and the urgency there is to try to get that line to game, which is the same distance in both leagues. But, you know, there's a lot more urgency in the Canadian. So the passing game has always been more prevalent since the CFL came in the 1950s, where the NFL took a little longer to what we see today.
Yeah. And even like, you know, in the Canadian football, the defensive line has to be 1 yard off the ball. Right. And so, you know, when we introduced the neutral zone in 1906, and, you know, they basically, I've never been able to figure out when the Canadians adopted the 1 yard off the ball. But, you know, that's part of the fact that they only have, it's not as big a difference in their game because, you know, they've only got three downs anyways, right? But, you know, if you're half a yard short, you're pretty much going to make it if you do a quarterback sneak.
Right. You know? Yeah. You ought to get a yard or two out of every QB sneak. That's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, that's just the way the game is. And, you know, everybody follows those rules and it works out. It's just fine. But I think that's actually one where, from a safety standpoint, you know, I've advocated in the past, that's something Americans should look at because, you know, so much of the pounding of the head that occurs for offensive and defensive linemen as a result of, you know, our neutral zone being the length of the ball. You widen that thing out and there'll be, you know, fewer head contacts, fewer, you know, and less severe.
Yeah, and that 1 yard's really not enough distance for somebody to gain great momentum to, you know, going back to the old flying wedges and everything like that. You know, a yard, you're both trying to advance forward, both the offensive and defensive player. So you're really only meeting at a half yard, you know, in a perfect world. So not as crushing as, you know, 20 yard head start full speed.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay. So how about the alluded to it a little bit, the field size, the CFL is quite a bit different in dimensions from the American football fields. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. So, you know, that's one where, you know, I think from the start, they had a bigger field, meaning a wider field. And when they, you know, obviously they have the thing that always, you know, makes Americans freak out is the, maybe not so much the width of the field, but it's the 55 yard line and then the end zones. Right. So, and people either just don't know, or they forget that the American field had a 55 yard line until 1912. 1912. So, and in fact, one of the tidbits that I did maybe a month ago was a picture at University of Michigan Notre Dame game. And it's a poor quality picture, but it's the only one I could find. You know, it's at the yard marker, you know, 55, sitting on the sideline. But you know, the American field had a 55 yard line, or it was also called midfield line, but and then at the until 1912, it didn't have, we didn't have an end zone. We had an area called, you know, in goal, but there was no end line. So, you know, if a ball got punted, you know, 20 yards past the goal line, then, well, that's just somebody had to go get it. You know, it's still in play. And so, but when they wanted, there was a rule in place where you couldn't throw a forward pass. If the forward pass went over the goal line, whether it bounced or flew, that was a touchback. And they wanted to eliminate that rule, but they didn't want to give the team, you know, they didn't want them to be able to run 40 yards deep into the end zone for a pass. So they put the end line in, and then they defined the end zone, which then made our field, instead of 110 yards of defined territory, that made it 130 yards of defined territory, because now you had two defined 10-yard end zones. And it simply wouldn't fit in certain stadiums like the polo grounds. So they kept the end zones 10 yards in length, but they got rid of the 55-yard line. So we ended up with a 100-yard field plus two 10-yard end zones. So, again, this is one. The Canadians maybe kind of copied us, you know, back in 1903 with the Burnside rules. But we're the ones who changed and got rid of the 55-yard line, not them.
Yeah, so because of those concrete stadiums that they were building, yeah, right at that time, they were sort of trapped into that size. And, you know, Harvard didn't want to rip down half their stadium and rebuild it, I'm sure, after it was only a couple of years.
Yeah, away. Well, that's the width portion of it. You know, when Harvard, when they first built, you know, Harvard Stadium, it was a U shape. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't enclosed. And I think they then eventually enclosed it, or, you know, had some temporary stands in the one end. But the, you know, if you look at pictures, you know, it's right up there. You know, it's like Kinnick Stadium in Iowa. You know, the stands are right there on top of the field. And so, you know, there was suggestions in 1905 to expand the width of the American football field. But, you know, Harvard had just built Harvard Stadium in 1903, and they're like, sorry, we're not changing. You know, and it was the first, among the first reinforced concrete buildings in the world, you know, and they were like, no, we're not moving this thing. You know?
And Harvard at the time is one of the big three of football anywhere, you know, Yale and Princeton. So they were quite influential at that time.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's one of those things, like just the artifact of having built that stadium. You know, if it had been a wooden stadium like everybody else's at the time, not a big deal. We can move it. But, you know, once it's in concrete, it's in concrete.
Yeah, that's for sure. I got a great opportunity probably almost 10 years ago now to get, I had a relative that was on the Yale staff, and I got a chance, it was during the off season, it was in summertime. I got a chance to get a tour of Yale Stadium. And, you know, I know Yale was built a few years after Harvard's, but I can't even imagine, you know, it's basically dug into the ground and then cemented all the way around, you know, in a big oval is the way it is today. And I imagine that it was probably a lot of its original, the design. It's it would be a massive task to try to make that field any wider or longer than it already is.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, I saw the Harvard Yale game at Harvard one time, and I've been to Yale for other reasons, but cool old stadiums, you know. Yeah, they're from a different time.
Definitely are. I think one of the biggest things was the outside of it. You know, I'm looking for a stadium. I don't really think they had lights at the, maybe they did, I can't remember if they had light poles, but the thing I'm looking for, these giant grandstands, you know, from the outside, and really the walls probably only maybe 20 foot tall off of ground level, and then when you walk in, it's dug into the ground, which is kind of unique.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, a lot of stadiums were like that back then. Rose Bowl was built in a similar way. You know, they try to find some kind of canyon or something, you know, they didn't have the same kind of earth moving equipment and excavation equipment that we have now. And so if you could find a natural hillside, you used it.
Yeah. You know? Oh, right. So put the seats there. You got your amphitheater all built just like the Romans.
Yeah, I mean, I think Camp Randall, you know, I'm a Wisconsin fan. Camp Randall has some of the same kinds of things. The Big House at Michigan, you know, I mean, that's an impressive structure, but it's a lot of that is underground, you know, so not unusual.
Yeah. Hmm, okay. All right. So, we got the field size. We got the three downs covered, some of the history of that. What are some of the other differences between what we deem as American football and Canadian football?
You know, I mean, you've got the, you know, the goalpost location, you know, would be one. So, you know, American football started out with the goalposts on the right on the goal line, or, you know, sitting 2 yards back, and then, you know, the crossbar and the poster over the goal line. You know, college football moved it in 1927, moved it to the end line. And the NFL did at that time as well, because they followed the college rules. And then when they created their own rule book in 33, they then moved it back to the goal line. And then once we had soccer style kickers who were too accurate, you know, then they said, oh, we better move those things back and make it at least 10 yards more difficult. And so then, you know, they've sat there ever since. But in the Canadian game, you know, it's been on the goal line all along. And I think for them, you know, part of it is just they've always had a longer or deeper end zone. And so there's more flexibility. You know, it's not quite as compact. They don't have as many plays right down there on the goal line where potentially, you know, you're going to run over the goalposts and those kinds of things. You know, passing is just a bigger option, as well as sweeps. You know, just you've got that much more flexibility in your play calling. So I think they've just never needed to relocate it. So, but, you know, there's that, and, you know, then going even further back, that I think one of, you know, the men in motion, you know, I mean, here's another place where the goofy Americans changed stuff on them. You know, like American football, because it was rugby, you know, there was no rule that said people couldn't be moving, you know, when the ball was snapped or, you know, the scrimmage or scrummage was going on. And so, and it stayed that way for quite a while. And then eventually, you know, the Americans said, okay, 1893, I think it was, they said only three men in motion, still allowing them to go forward if they wanted to. And then, you know, there was kind of a succession of changes, largely because of this mass play and momentum plays, all the running up the gut, you know, teams would send three guys right through the same hole as, and they, you know, they didn't have a rule on seven men on the line of scrimmage. So they'd have like three guys on the line of scrimmage and two guards back. And, you know, they'd just be sending guys through a hole. And that was, I mean, that's where a lot of the danger came from. So the, you know, requiring seven men to be on the line of scrimmage, and then the you know, reducing to only one man in motion, and he had to be either going parallel to or away from the line of scrimmage. That was all safety related. So, whereas in Canadian, well, it was still Canadian rugby at the time, you know, their game, they didn't allow blocking, well, you know, what they called interference, but they didn't allow blocking until 1921. Okay, so that tells you something about the rugby nature of the game, because rugby doesn't allow blocking, right? And so, because that man is offside, he's in front of the man with the ball. So, so because, you know, I mean, we kind of solved the mass and momentum thing by restricting men in motion. They never had the mass momentum thing going on. So it was just fine to, you know, I mean, they didn't allow blocking at the time we were having the momentum issues, right? So, you know, we kind of solved that problem. You know, we kept the momentum, or we kept the blocking and eliminated motion, whereas they ultimately added blocking first, just within the first 4 yards from scrimmage, things like that. It was things evolving at different times, kind of somewhat parallel paths, but, you know, they lagged behind us in terms of allowing blocking. And then, you know, from that point on, once they kind of allowed blocking, then things started edging more and more towards the American game. The forward pass was first allowed in the late 20s out in like Western Canada. So the Western Canada and Eastern Canada have always had different views of the game, which kind of reinforces the East-West, nature of the CFL, which is fun. And even, you know, the college leagues as well. And then, you know, the forward pass was legalized all over Canada in 1931. So, you know, so again, very much of a rugby style game until the 20s, 30s, you know, and then from that point on, especially once they started importing American players and American coaches, then all of a sudden, you know, the Americanization of the game becomes, you know, a bigger factor.
Yeah, I always kind of found that interesting. Where you say, you know, how the forward pass sort of came, you know, a decade and a half earlier, was developed in the American game than it was in the Canadian game, but especially, you know, when they are embracing those three downs, they're, you know, like you're saying, they're not blocking for some time during that. And you would almost think that that forward pass would have been, hey, you know, here's our answer. This is a great gift here. And that they would have embraced it, you know, sooner than we would have in America. And I just kind of find that always a little bit odd.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly, you know, why it all happened. I think some of it, and even like the difference in the Western teams versus Eastern, you know, if you were a Canadian team out West, and again, it was all amateur, you know, I mean, Canadian football was the Grey Cup and everything. That was all amateur till, you know, late 50s, maybe. I mean, they had some paid players. It was more like semi-pro in many respects. But, you know, I mean, teams would have like some guys who were getting paid some good money, and then other guys who, you know, were virtually, you know, playing for free or whatever. But, you know, the teams out West are just more isolated, you know. And so some of them just had to find teams to play, and they played American teams, you know. And so I think they just, you know, whereas, you know, things are just like in the U.S. geographically, things are tighter. There's more population in the East. And so they had more folks that they could play. And even though their leagues would have like only four teams, you'd think they'd get bored out of their minds playing the same people over and over again. But, you know, so they were able to kind of stick to their game. And, you know, they loved the game. You know, I mean, there's people all over the world loved rugby still, you know. Right. They just kind of, you know, made a slower transition from rugby to, you know, gridiron. So, okay. You know, not good or bad. It's just different.
Right. Right. It's just an interesting thing. I always find kind of interesting on there. Now, speaking of interesting, there's this extra scoring, play or event that happens in Canadian football over what we recognize in American football. Maybe you could explain that to us a little bit.
Yeah. So I think now it's officially just called the single, but the single or the rouge. They have always had, or they still have, a couple of elements that are, harken back to the rugby days, right? So the kicking punting game is a bigger part of Canadian football than American football. Even as important as it is, you know, in the U.S. So there's, so I'll get to each of these, but, you know, we've got the onside punt, the return kick, and then the single or the rouge. And so, you know, in the Canadian game, if you kick or punt the ball into the opponent's end zone, they have to get it out of the end zone. And if they don't, then you get a point. Right. So it's very much of a field position, you know, thinking game, which, you know, is what rugby and everything was in American football early on. So it still holds that field position oriented thinking. One of the things that somebody who's in the end zone can do, and they can do it anywhere on the field, if you catch a punt, you can punt it right back, right? That's called a return kick. And you could do that in the NCAA until 1963. People stopped doing it kind of in the 20s, but it was still legal until 63. So, you know, every once in a while you read an article and you see mention of a return kick. And, you know, it's, again, under a field position game, if you didn't have much of an offense and you had a pretty good defense, the best thing you could do is catch the punt, punt it right back to him right now. Now. And you could do it on an interception. You could do it on any change of possession. You could return kick. So, you know, that, and that's still part of the Canadian game. So every once in a while, you'll see a clip come over on, you know, Twitter or whatever of an exchange in a Canadian game. A lot of times when somebody gets the ball in the end zone and they, boom, kick it right back. And then they catch it and they kick it right back. And so sometimes it goes on, you know, two or three kicks, you know, and it's just a fascinating thing because Americans look at it and go, oh, this is bizarre. What are they doing here? You know,
and some of them are going, this is blasphemy. You have the ball. Why are you giving it back?
Well, you know, and, you know, once offense has got advanced enough that, you know, you could be pretty confident you could move the ball, then it made no sense to do the return kick. Right. Unless, you know, there were certain circumstances, like it's a tie game. And if I don't get the ball out of this end zone, you know, I'm going to give the other team a point. Right. So, you know, but we don't face that in America. But another one is the onside kick. So, you know, in American thinking, an onside kick is a kickoff that, you know, has to travel 10 yards and then either team can pick it up. But, you know, again, hearkening back to the rugby days, there's an element of American football where we had what was called a quarterback kick oftentimes, but also an onside kick. And there were kind of two different versions of it that existed at different times. But long and short of it, the quarterback kick was around from the beginning of the game until 1922, I think it was. But basically the quarterback would get the snap, you know, in a normal T formation. So three backs behind the quarterback, he'd get the snap and he'd punt it. And a lot of times he'd try to punt it kind of at an angle. And then anybody who was behind the guy with the ball, behind the quarterback who was punting the ball, they could run down there and recover the ball, you know, just like on our kick off onside kick. And then one of the rule changes in 1906 was they made everyone eligible to recover the ball. And they thought, you know, there was a big contention. There were a lot of people. Pop Warner thought that was, you know, that was going to be a more important change than the forward pass. Right. And, you know, a lot of other people thought the same thing, but, you know, it didn't work out that way. But, you know, so anyways, this onside kick is still part of the Canadian game. Right. So if you, you know, you punt it and one of your guys can go down there, the punting team can recover the ball and maintain possession of it. So, you know, it's one of those, you know, it's a nod to the rugby origins of their game.
I'm sure it makes an already exciting punt play that much more exciting. That's for sure. That's the ones as officials, you know, the kicking game, that's where all the wild stuff happens. That's where you know, officials have to have a head on a swivel. You know, scrimmage plays is one thing. You know where the guys are starting. You might not know which way they're going, but you know where they're starting from and, you know, pretty much the flow. But the kicking game, almost anything can happen when you have a loose ball. That's for sure.
Yeah. Well, and they, you know, they also, you know, the punter or the punt receiver they don't allow the fair catch in Canadian football. But the gunners or, you know, anybody coming down on the punting team who's covering the punt, they have to stay, you know, 5 yards away from the guy receiving the punt. So, you know, it adds that exciting element to the game. They're forced to, you know, to catch the ball, but they're not going to get slammed. You know, they're not going to have somebody running full speed.
So they're operating almost like the NCAA had the 5 yard bubble. They have the bubble on the punt receiver then, rather than have the interference. Fair catch.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Okay. You know, so it's you know, same kind of notion, but you know, so again, it makes the, you know, if you're gonna, obviously they're gonna punt a lot more in their game with only three downs. And so so that allows the excitement to remain, because you know, the punt return can be a really exciting play in football. As can the kick return, but you know, they could also be very dangerous plays. So,
yeah, it seems, you know, the more the NFL rules are evolving, they're trying to eliminate the free kick, the kickoff returns, you know, moving the kickers up and letting them kick in the end zone more often, so you have more touchbacks. There's been talks every year in the NFL about totally eliminating the free kick. And the punting game is, you know, they was wide open.
Yeah. I think kickoff returns can be such exciting plays, but you know, I advocate for getting rid of them. You know, Amos Alonzo Stagg said get rid of them back in like 1905. So, you know, there's a pretty good history of people who recognize it's a dangerous play. Very high percentage of injuries occur on kickoff, you know, relative to the, you know, all other plays, kickoff returns are horrible, you know, from a injury standpoint. Get rid of them.
But, yeah. Yeah. Well, we might have to have another conversation one of these days on suggestions of what to do with that play. That might be an interesting topic someday. So,
I mean, I think, you know, part of the thing too is just, I did want to just add one other point on the single. So, I've just come across this fairly recently, but at the real early stages of American football, you know, they were calling, you know, writers used to refer to, you know, quote, the extra point as a single. You know, it wasn't really it wasn't a single point at the time, but they still called it. I think they were adopting some of the Canadian language, but the single, you know, it was the first point scored in a Canadian national championship game before the Grey Cup was a single. So,
really?
So it's been a part of their game for a long time.
Well, Tim, you know, we really appreciate you coming on here and talking about, you know, these differences in the CFL and the NFL, or the Canadian game and the average American game. You know, I guess this transfers to all levels, high school up through the pros, both in Canada and America. The rules are different from high school, college, and the NFL here in the States, but basically the same game. For the CFL, I think they use pretty much the same rule book at their different levels of football up there. I think it's all the same there, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, you know, I can't even tell you that. You know, Football Canada is their governing body for amateur football.
Let me put it this way. Their high school game and college game and pro game are more similar to each other than ours are. I guess maybe that's maybe a fair statement to say.
If this podcast gets a couple of people to pay attention, you know, watch a couple of Canadian games. It's a fun game, you know. It's a very exciting game, and it's excellent football. I mean, a lot of players and everything. The fans love it. I mean, just like, you know, I mean, it's maybe, you know, I guess I can compare Canadian football fans are kind of like hockey fans in the US, you know, it's a little bit niche, you know, there's a lot of Canadians who, you know, love the NFL too, but so it's a little bit niche, but you know, they love being in that niche, you know, I mean, they're loyal, you know, good fans, and you know, it's just, it's a fun game. It's just, and you know, I turn on games, I'm reading or I'm doing research, whatever I'm doing, and I've got it on in the background and pop my head up to watch the return kick or two.
Right.
Hope that it comes up.
Right. And the other thing is it's consistent, other than a COVID year. It's consistent of, basically 2 months of meaningful football before the college and the NFL seasons kick off here.
Yeah.
So that's the best time, watching them, sweat it out in the hot summer days. And, when we don't have anything else really going on here. So
And for me, the atmosphere feels a bit more like the U.S. college game, which I prefer over the NFL, but that's, again, to each their own. But it's a fun game, and definitely worth a watch. So just encourage people to watch.
Yeah, and I know last year they ran them on ESPN Plus for those that don't live near the border like we do, that we can pull in some Canadian stations or buy a TSN package or anything. But ESPN Plus, I know, had some games last year, and I think they plan on covering some this year too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and ESPN Plus is just the TSN package.
Is that what it is? Okay.
Yeah, so I subscribe to that for there's a college basketball team or two that I watch that way as well, but that's it's one of my subscriptions.
Yeah, okay.
It gets me a good number of the CFL games.
Okay, well speaking of subscriptions, that's a good segue. Why don't you tell us again about where people can go to your site and opt to one of your multiple subscription plans that you have there, and also give us your social media again.
Yeah, so my site is www.footballarchaeology.com. And you can find me under the same name on Twitter and on Facebook. Again, basically everything I post on football archaeology, I kind of double post or triple post, to the other two. But the value of the subscribing is, you will get a, if you're, depending on how many people you follow on Twitter, any single feed can get buried in all the other stuff. So if you subscribe, you'll get the email with the contents of each post. And it's, again, it's free. Now I am going to be, there's also paid subscriptions that serve two purposes. One is it basically pays me money what it does mostly is it funds, like, it costs me money to buy images and acquire licenses and those kinds of things. And so, it basically subsidizes that a bit. But I will be adding content that only paid subscribers will get. And right now it's probably going to be two things. I'm going to start a podcast competing with you.
It's never a competition when you're doing the same job of preserving football history. So that's the way I look at it.
Yeah. But at least initially, a lot of what I'm going to do on the podcast is basically contents of what will be my third book, but I'm probably going to serialize the book on my website first. So this third book, I have a title already, but I'll just call it Football Words, but that's not the real title. But essentially it's just looking at how football terminology developed and what was happening in football at the time that required new terms. So, like, when did weak side and strong side come in? What was happening in football at the time that terms like that emerged? That's just one example. Middle linebacker, outside linebacker, what was happening in football then that required new terms? It's going to be kind of little more along the lines of like my today's tidbits, just quick hitting, one or two page, three page, little notes. So bite-sized chunks,
little nuggets from the book.
Yeah. Yeah. So instead of, my current books are things, you got to sit down and read a 350 page book. This one could be a bathroom reader. I mean, you can read it from start at the beginning and end at the end if you want, or you can just, put it on the, put it wherever it is that you have an extra moment or two and just want to be able to pick something up, flip to a page and read. And so it could serve that purpose as well.
Yeah. But please, listeners, don't do it while you're driving or something dangerous like that. Especially if I'm following you. We don't
do that. Yeah. No, don't do either of the two things I suggested.
That message is for you, lady, that puts on her makeup. It's in front of me every morning. That's a message for you. So, well, Tim, we thank you again for coming on and sharing some of your knowledge and your research and enlightening us about another element of the game of football, whether it's Canadian or American or wherever it's played. The gridiron game is loved, and we appreciate you coming on here and sharing it.
Well, always fun, always a good time. And you've got my email and my phone number, so whenever, I'm more than happy to come on and chat.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Do you wish you knew more about the 100 seasons of the NFL? You're in luck, because you found the Football History Dude podcast, where each episode is a journey back in time to learn about the rich history of the NFL. From the founding of the league in an auto showroom, all the way to what it is today, America's favorite sport and a behemoth of an industry. My name is Ernie Chapman. Football is my passion, and I want you to come along with me each week to explore the yesteryear of the gridiron. So hop on board my DeLorean, and let's get this baby up to 88 miles per hour.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.